Revelation 10, not 10, 12. And I believe we did not quite finish. I believe we have some verses to go.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, we have starting with verse 12.
Right. 12:12.
Nancy, I'm asking you instead of Bill since you like to read too. So this is.
I like to read. Thanks to Mr. Barnes, who when I was in first grade, we'd go out and I'd read to him, and I've loved to read ever since first grade, thanks to Mr. Barnes, who was my teacher's husband, who would come in and support her. So, all right, so this is from Free Bible Version, starting in 12 to what? How far do you want me to go? The end of the chapter or
Yeah.
okay.
Yes, please.
So celebrate heaven and everyone who lives there. Mourn earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you and is very angry, knowing his time is short. When the dragon realized he had been thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the wings of a large eagle, so she could fly away to a deserted place where she could be looked after for a time, times, and half a time, protected from the serpent. The serpent spewed water like a river out of his mouth, trying to sweep her away in the flood. The earth came to the woman's aid by opening its mouth and swallowing up the river that the dragon spewed out of his mouth. The dragon was furious with the woman and went off to attack the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commandments and have the testimony of Jesus.
You know, Adventists have a tendency to try to imagine what everything means. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes I don't know. And one of the I don't knows about this, the river and the earth swallowing the river, was I had a teacher who taught an archaeology class I took it at Loma Linda University. Actually, it was on the La Sierra campus. He was part of Loma Linda University. And he taught us that he believed that the river was atheism and agnosticism, and that the earth that swallowed it open was archaeology.
Oh, that's interesting.
There's a job security for you.
I thought maybe a little bit of humor might be an interesting start. At the time, I was like, well, I was considerably younger and hadn't thought things through as much.
But you did question it.
Makes a great story, anyway. What do we do with rivers? Symbolism of rivers.
Well, I think it's helpful to notice that it came from his mouth. Because in
Important river after the
Revelation,
woman.
there's a lot of symbols that have to do with the mouth. So Jesus has a sword in his mouth. The dragon, I can't remember anywhere where it talks about fire coming out of the dragon's mouth, does it? That's more tradition.
Let's see, that would be 13.
But the dragon's not part of 13 except the first verse.
Yeah, that's true. I was thinking the beast. I was thinking the beast. The fire beast makes fire come down in its
Right,
presence.
right. So about the only thing I can remember coming out of the dragon's mouth, particularly now in Job, he sneezes and there's coals and fire and all that
Right.
stuff. But that's in Job. That's not here in Revelation.
Right.
It's, this is the only thing I can remember coming out of its mouth
And
is water.
even then, I think the fire, his eyes flash fire, isn't it?
Well, it also
And
talks
Job
about him sneezing.
sneezing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that we have a parallel to this in the Bible.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk to you a little bit about rivers in the ancient Near East. Rivers were judges.
Where were rivers judges? In the
ancient Near East.
Near East.
I know of two examples. The Euphrates River was a judge in Mesopotamia. In fact, they had the trial by ordeal, where a person had to cast themselves in the river to prove their innocence or guilt.
Then they drown, right? Was that part of they would, was it sink or swim? Or
it was not like the Salem, Massachusetts type of witches. It had to do with if you swam or made it across or whatever, or was able to not sink, you were innocent. And if you started drowning, you were guilty. I had a professor claim that they would fish them out and then kill them if they were guilty. But I don't think that was the truth, because there were actual documents that tell how this happened. And they actually found the victim downriver, all bashed in, his body mutilated terribly by the gods, presumably. In fact, scholars used to poo-poo that this even happened, that this was just fiction that they were reading about. And then they found actual documentation of it. If that happened in Mesopotamia, it's possible that it could have happened in Syria as well, where in the Syria, a Canaanite cultures, they refer to Judge River in the bowl cycles. Given that, it's very tempting to me to think of this as Satan using his masterful skills at being the accuser and the judge, self-appointed judge, to create trials by ordeal for the woman and her offspring, as he did for Job. You could call Job's trials a trial by ordeal. Because the devil claimed he was guilty. God allowed the devil to tempt Job and try his soul to prove that he was guilty, but Job proved innocent. That's how I'm tempted to interpret this. An interesting twist on this is Naaman, the Syrian, who came to Elisha to get healed from his leprosy. You remember how angry he was being sent to the Jordan River to wash. Mm-hmm. Or not the rivers up where I live better than the Jordan River. Why? Because it's his own God judging him instead of this foreign God judging him. And God doesn't judge him. This is the switch in the story. Mm-hmm. God doesn't judge him. He heals him. And I love that cast that the story gives, that God is not the judge, but the healer.
Here's some verses that I'm always attaching links to every phrase. And here's a few interesting ones. I was just scanning through them. Psalms 18:4, the cords of death surrounded me. The floods of ungodliness made me afraid. Which might fit here.
Yeah, I could.
And then Song of Solomon, a very familiar one, 8:7. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man would give the wealth of his house for love, he would be utterly scorned.
Do any of those verses talk about specifically rivers?
Yeah, but let me see. Okay, Isaiah 8:7. Behold, the Lord brings upon them the mighty floodwaters of the river, the king of Assyria, and all his glory. It will come up over its channels and go over all of its banks.
Okay, so there, river, the floodwaters of the river, can mean our enemy forces.
Yeah.
That fits with ancient Near Eastern perception of storms as enemy forces.
And then Isaiah 28:2, the Lord is a mighty and strong one, like a storm of hail, a destroying storm, like a storm of mighty waters overflowing. He will cast them down to the earth with his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And 59:19, he will come as a rushing stream with which the breath of Yahweh drives. So those are a few of them.
So when we're trying to look at this within the context, because the dragon initially had attempted to persecute the woman who was given the wings of a great eagle and escaped. And, you know, it talks about the time frame, specifically about time, times, and half a time. And then it identifies this switch in strategies, however you want to call it, where he tries to overwhelm her, you know, drowning. I'm a good swimmer, but I've been on the Salmon River and some mighty rivers where you go, I don't want to be in that water. It is swift and treacherous, and there's these, you know, swirling eddies that can drag you under no matter how good of a swimmer you are. So, you know, I'm just trying to put in context, you know, he persecuted, but then there's this other approach, which is also intended to wipe her out, but it's different, you know, and there is this intervention that God sends to absorb what was intended to sweep her away. So I'm just trying to say, okay, what does that tell us about what, you know, Satan's strategy? And, you know, it was obviously coming towards her. The earth opens up is what it sounds like, that there was some intervention that God made to prevent drowning, you know, being overwhelmed and killed, you know, I mean, just with that metaphor of waters overwhelming. I just go, yep, he's trying to kill her, take her out yet again.
And in chapter 17, you know, the angel says that the waters represent peoples and nations and languages and things like that. So, I mean, that's typically a go-to as far as the symbol of water.
Is that often referred to as sea? I think of seas as people and groups and,
yeah, you know. You know, I heard someone propose that there is a difference between waters and sea in the symbols in Revelation. And they had a pretty compelling argument, but I can't find that recording anymore. So I wanted to go back and review it, but they said there was a distinct difference between the two.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I would welcome that, because seas, did they think the seas were peoples and the waters were different, or the other way around?
You know, I can't remember. I listened. You know, they were actually doing Revelation, and they had some very novel, different ideas from what we were used to, but they had some very solid scriptural reasoning behind it. And, you know, and I found it intriguing, but then I thought I had a recording of it, and I've looked everywhere and I can't find it.
Because seas and the deep have to do with chaos and evil.
Mm-hmm.
In ancient Near Eastern thought and in biblical thought in the Old Testament. So I've always wanted to go that way instead of peoples, multitudes and peoples and so on. I could see the waters being referring to.
How would that relate to the sea of glass?
It's not dark.
It's transparent.
Well, maybe that's why it's shot through with fire, to differentiate it between the dark chaos.
Right.
That this sea is really more like, in fact, I think that resonates very strongly with this intense, I believe, glassy mirror surface on the Sea of Galilee after Jesus calmed the storm. I think it was so calm, it shocked them. When you got a smooth, glassy surface with not even a single ripple on it, it would look like a sea of glass, and they're going, what just happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, if the earth, though, is filled with a river of water, doesn't necessarily mean chaos, but it can. I think it can.
Can it be a flood of lies? Because lies are perpetuated by people, obviously. They don't come out of nowhere.
That's true, but I'm thinking back to creation.
Mm-hmm.
when the spirit hovered over the face of the deep.
You also have the four rivers.
It actually went over the waters. I'm misstating this, I'm sure.
You know, you got those intriguing descriptions of the rivers coming out of Eden that I've never heard discussed very much either.
Well, there's four rivers.
Yeah.
The earth was formless and void, and darkness was moving, was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you have a clear reference to waters.
Right.
And that, as far as I can see, represents chaos and evil. And God's way of dealing with chaos and evil is say, let there be light. So that fits with what you suggest about the sea of glass, having fire lighting it up.
Hmm. And the sea of glass has fire in it.
Yeah. It's mingled with fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, a river can, well, everything Satan does is a counterfeit.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like to
well,
me.
There's a river that comes out of Jerusalem.
And you got the river of life.
Right.
So this well, would be the opposite of the river of life.
Yeah.
And to destroy.
Right.
So if we look at this, you know, I grew up with a historicist perspective. And, you know, we look at that at that time of intense persecution to the church. And then there was a switch. There was a change when that actually escalated people's appreciation for somebody who's willing to die. And so didn't Satan switch gears after the 1260 years of intense persecution? Wasn't there a switch in his strategy? Is that at all referenced in the, so that didn't work. So now he's trying to overwhelm, sweep people away, sweep them off their feet. They're standing, you know, so you're overwhelmed with,
you know, I think
less effective and, you know, distracted.
I think that what is being talked about is the time after that the great persecution when, this is from the historicist view now, when the earth comes to help in the new world.
Right. That's how I heard it growing up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I did too.
They got heavy because they had an ocean between them.
That's not how I was taught, actually, historicists.
How are you taught?
That this happened during the 1260 years. And that, and you know, you read in Great Controversy how the Waldenses and the Huguenots and all of them went to the mountains.
That's true.
And the flood of armies that tried to go in there to kill them often, it was just absorbed. They couldn't, I mean, eventually they would exterminate them many times, but that's why they went to the wilderness, because they were almost unreachable.
That makes more sense. And yes, I was reading that time frame incorrectly. So it's
I guess, you know, there were two views in the Adventist church, but because I heard the same thing as Nancy. But, you know, either one works as far as I'm concerned.
But again, it seems like he keeps switching tactics. This didn't work. So he switched, this doesn't work.
Oh, yeah. He will switch tactics.
Time, you know, so he goes off to attack the rest of the offspring. You know, mm-hmm. So there's this, again, switch, which I think we'll hear more about as we get into the following chapters of Revelation, right? So the persecution didn't work in the way that he hoped it would.
I would like to propose, Lord Floyd, that you could be right, that he poured a flood of lies out of his mouth. What else would come out of the Satan's mouth?
That's what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is immediately after the child is caught up to heaven, which more and more, I believe, you know, from the larger perspective, the revelation of truth that was unleashed by the life and death and resurrection of Jesus is far, far greater than from our vantage point than we can begin to imagine. Because we live after 2,000 years of a whole new flood of lies about the life and death of Jesus that have completely misconstrued and reinterpreted why Jesus died and all that stuff, you know, and I've struggled for 50 years to try to unlearn all those horrific explanations of the cross and get to what the real truth was. But I think that real truth was crystal clear to the early believers, which is why they were on fire and almost unstoppable. And so over the next 100, 200 years, Satan was scrambling to reinvent and reinterpret everything that they were teaching because it was such a threat to his kingdom. And he had to come out with a whole new raft of lies to suffocate that light. And now we're living at the other end of that tunnel, and we're trying to come out of that darkness back into the original light, and we're fighting against tradition. And I think the same thing is going to happen after the millennium. And because you see the sequence there, the beast and the false prophet are thrown into the lake of fire before the second coming, which means they're exposed. All the lies that Satan has relied on up to that point are fully exposed. So after the millennium and everybody's resurrected, wait a minute, you can't hide because you can't use those lies anymore because there's too many people already know about them. He's already been exposed. So he has to come up with a whole nother raft of lies to convince everybody who's resurrected to unite with him. And he has, he's got to start all over again for like the third or fourth time with lies. And he's really good at that.
It's native language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting that verse 17, you know, identifies the intensity of his furiousness, his anger. And it would make sense if we have the, not an imposed view of God, but recognizing that those who keep God's commandments love God, love others. And they have the same thing to say about God that Jesus did. They're aligning with this is the truth about who God is, which is ultimately the testimony about Jesus, which is why Satan's so furious, because that's that interferes with his lies. If you accept that view of an authoritarian, imposed dictator God who makes up rules and then has the right to judge and enforce punishment for whatever rules you break instead of design law concept, and God just calls us to be aligned with what brings life.
Cause and effect.
Yeah. The thing I have a question about now that we've switched to from a river to lies is, how does the earth come to the help of the woman and swallow the river of lies?
In this case, can the earth in some sense represent the natural principles that govern reality that are going to be constantly contradicting the counterfeit artificial system?
Maybe the rise of science.
Yeah.
Early science, not necessarily evolutionary science, but Newtonian science.
I mean, I can see multiple applications all dovetailing together.
I think we can, because I was thinking of another possibility that the earth, if it did represent the new world, the new world was an experiment eventually. It wasn't immediately, but it was eventually an experiment of how to live life in a freer, more democratic atmosphere.
Which would be the beast that arose out of the earth.
Well, that's right.
Revelation 13. Right. And originally, the beast wasn't all that bad.
Right.
It was actually helping to absorb the flood of lies and the refugees. It had the two horns like the lamb.
Right.
Yes, it was an experiment in a government closer to God's design. And it's only over time, just like everything else, over time, it succumbs
right to those the design two horns of Satan. Become, those two horns become less than democratic.
But that would make sense, both what nature reveals, since it is created by God, and its design principles of the interconnected, the taking to give principle that all earth is based on, would help overcome the lies that Satan's preaching about evolution and about you can just declare whoever you want to be, male or female, that there's no, and that there's no cause and effect. There's no, when you make a choice, you know, that you need an arbitrary judge to inflict punishment instead of saying that's a natural consequence of choice. Just like we, you know, recognize if I jump off a building, gravity is going to have its impact. There's no gravity police, as Dr. Jennings likes to say. You know, so it makes sense to me that Satan's lies can be in part overcome by looking at how design law functions. It's a way to absorb that and to say this doesn't have to his lies don't have to take you out because you look at how
that would
function.
Yeah, that would work with the next line. So the earth has helped the woman. It has absorbed to a great extent the lies. Mm-hmm. So now he's going to make war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's not going to try lies anymore. He's just going to outright try to overcome by force. And I think that's what we're beginning to see today.
Well, and don't forget who it is behind helping the woman. It says to the place God had prepared for her. So God could be doing any number of miracles with the earth to negate whatever the devil's trying to do to destroy, whether it be swallow up the lies or through the earth or whatever. God's a part of the rescue.
It's really acting as a buffering agent, isn't it? Because it doesn't completely stop, but it sort of, I mean, I guess the imagery that comes to me is, you know, there are some places on the earth, in Africa for one, where rivers, big rivers, will run out and just disappear because it just soaks into the ground and that's it. They're gone.
Yeah.
They're literally swallowed up by the earth because there's more earth than there is water and it just disappears.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have any rivers like that in America, do we? Our rivers all go to the sea.
We get a few sinkholes that do square things.
That's true.
But I, you know, I've been intrigued for years on this description of the four rivers in Eden, because it seems like they operate almost under a different system, the way they're described, because it's, you know, it's backwards. There, number one, there was no sea of significant size. One river flows out of Eden and splits into four, which is opposite of how our rivers do. And then each one of those rivers go to the four different directions of the earth, and they go out to water the whole earth. Wait a minute. It doesn't happen that way after the flood. You know, the water goes up through the sky and falls down and comes back through the rivers, whereas in Eden, it's describing as coming from the river and going out to water the earth. And I've always puzzled over that. You know, it's like, well, why don't you let it actually say what it says instead of saying, well, that's impossible. They must have wrote it wrong. Well, maybe science worked a little different before the flood than it does now.
Mm-hmm. So is this a return to the four rivers? I don't know. I think I made a leap there that wasn't.
Well, I do think there's some kind of connection. I think it's a counterfeit use of that, but that certainly parallels the idea of a river going out and then soaking into the ground, which it really is how it's described in Genesis 2.
Well, if it goes out and is soaking into the ground, all along its route to where it goes, so that it waters everything as it goes. I can see that being God's original plan.
Well, this seems to affirm that God as creator is in charge of nature, you know, and metaphorically, whatever Satan spews at us, God will take care of. God, if we look to him, will rescue us from whatever Satan's trying to do to overwhelm us. So it seems to affirm God as creator and protector for us. He's always coming to our aid, right? Whatever Satan throws at us, God can help us deal with whatever strategy he's employing.
Now, there's another river metaphor that is sort of a cross between the two. The one in Ezekiel, where this trickle comes out from under the door. And then he goes out and measures it, and it's deeper and it's deeper and deeper until you got to swim across it. But then it says, wherever it goes, it brings life. So now you're starting with the small and going to the big, like we're more used to. And yet it's spreading life everywhere it goes. Which would be the counterpart of this one the dragon is spewing out, which is to destroy life.
Right. That's a good point. Because what it does is confirm the contrast between God, the life giver, and Satan, the destroyer. Yeah.
And why would Satan be trying to destroy? Not just because they're people or God's children, but because they have the nature or character of Jesus, as I understand it, by the testimony, nature, character of Jesus. And that's what I think Satan's trying to destroy. Is it not?
Yeah, he hates the light, and they are demonstrating what he says is impossible. And anytime you've got a liar who builds his whole empire on fundamental lies, and somebody comes along and keeps exposing that, the only thing you can do is try to eliminate them. If you can't convince them to stop and stop incriminating you, then you have to resort to violence to get rid of them at all means possible.
Which we learn more about as we review the beast coming up. It's always power, force, coercion, destruction there.
It seems to me that this is a kind of preamble to 13. It's introducing how the scenario worked. At first, he went after people, went after the woman, and she was given first a hiding place in the wilderness. That wasn't successful, apparently. So he does this river thing. The earth comes to her help and only promotes the truth about his lies ever more fully. And so he goes out to make war. And he's going to create a false trinity in the process.
Yeah.
Yep. That's good, a good point. Context, right?
And that brings up a good point that the transition to chapter 13 is an artificial break, because different versions say different things in verse 1 of 13, which I'm not real happy with mine in this case. Usually it's better, but in 13:1, mine says, I stood on the stand of the sea. I went and looked in the Greek. There is nobody referred to there. There is no I. So it's actually inferring that whoever was being talked about last is the one standing on the shore of the sea, which would be the dragon. And there are some versions that say the dragon was standing on the shore of the sea, and then out of the sea came this beast. That would make more sense, because if you take the chapter break out and let it go right through, it's talking about the dragon, and it's still talking about the dragon. It hasn't stopped. And so it's assuming you're thinking about the dragon. So that's who's standing on the shore of the sea. And of course, he's orchestrating this rising up of a beast out of the sea. And then he's orchestrating the rising up of the beast out of the land, or at least hijacking it.
I'm looking at the Greek right here. And I saw out of the sea. And the word is Therion. Therion is beast. So I have, in my Greek New Testament, I have beast.
Trish might be trying to say.
At the beginning, beginning of the verse where it says, I stood on the sand of the sea. There's no I there, is there? It doesn't say who's standing on the sand.
It's just so, Floyd, it's third person, so it's going to be he or she. There is no actual pronoun there, but the verb is person. So it's, you're right, it was not going to be I, it's going to be he. He stood.
And referencing dragon, Trish?
In my Greek, okay, this is my Greek version, there is no reference, there is no explicit subject. It's just he, you know, he.
He stood.
So you have to pick out who he is from the context of the rest of the passage.
Right. And it just, the last verse had said the dragon was furious, went off to make war. And it's interesting, as we read 13, it becomes pretty obvious Satan is the force behind these political systems that always use power, force, coercion. Even though it doesn't explicitly, he's referenced. So at least that's where my brain goes, not knowing Greek, but.
Yeah. I mean, logically, it could be, I think you're right. I mean, I think it is probably the dragon, but, you know, in the sentence right before, it talks about those who have the testimony of Jesus. I don't know, could be Jesus. I mean, it's probably the dragon, you're right. I mean, all I'm saying is it could, from that sentence, the link between 12 and 13, that from the sentence, there's no subject. So yeah, you have to infer.
Mm-hmm. I know when Siegfried, it's been a while since I reviewed 12, but he talks about the sequence of, you know, Satan acting, God responding, Satan acting, God responding, that there's this constant play between these two in the great controversy. And so, and reading context is the only way we know, how does this fit with, does this describe God or does this describe Satan, to know who the two major parties are.
Right.
But thanks for making that plainer.
Thank you, Trish. This keeping the commandments of God, or God's commandments, as my version has it, and hold firmly to the witness of Jesus. What are the commandments of God? How do we read that?
I wonder if they're not synonymous with the commandments of Moses.
Yeah, I think they are, personally, just because of the wording there.
Would they be the Ten Commandments?
But yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No. I think it's, again, not.
I think you cut out.
Trish said they were she was having thunderstorms back in the Carolinas where she is. So she says, I hope I'll be able to stay connected. But that was what was in her weather forecast.
Okay.
So hopefully
Nancy, it's not the weather, it's the Wi-Fi.
Oh, the Wi-Fi. There you go. Okay. Yes. Blame the weather.
Commands of God, if Jesus is God, and he summarized the whole law and the prophets in two commands, love God, love your neighbor as yourself, love's the fulfillment of the law.
That's what Paul says.
Mm-hmm. Love you a lot less than what
love is the fulfilling of the law.
Yeah, exactly.
I did a paper for a Festschrift last year on how Jesus interpreted the Old Testament in terms of the Beatitudes, not the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, but only chapter 5, the law. And it was an awesome experience because I've never felt the Holy Spirit so completely take over and guide me in my thought processes. I thought things that I didn't really know where I was going, but I thought I knew where I was going. And it turned out I went somewhere I wasn't planning to go. But at the end of it, I realized that Jesus was supporting the hermeneutic of love to read the law. Mm-hmm. So I see this as the law of love. This mm-hmm. is exactly. This is a delineation human beings can understand and grasp for God's character. Yes. This is how I work. This is how you're to work. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That is exactly how the Passion Translation puts a footnote here on the testimony of Jesus. They have the character and nature of Jesus. It is the power of the faithful testimony of Jesus, not ours, that has power to overcome the devil. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if that's the case, what is Jesus' witness?
Here's an interesting rephrasing of that, possibly.
Well,
they keep the commandments of God because they believe the testimony of Jesus. If the testimony of Jesus is our true identity, by believing the truth about who we are and about who God is, we are going to keep the commandments of God by reflection.
Right.
When you believe the truth about who you are, then you act like yourself.
Right.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, going back to the Greek again, the part where it talks about the testimony of Jesus, the verb there is to have. So it's having the witness, having the testimony of Jesus, which would be more of an identity thing, mm-hmm. at least in English.
And in chapter 1, he calls himself the true witness. Mm-hmm. And he talks a lot, especially in the book of John, about, you know, I came to bear witness to the truth. Mm-hmm. The whole war is over the truth, and it's the truth about what God is like, how mm-hmm. he acts, how he relates to people who don't like him, how he treats people who rebel against him. That's the whole war is over what is God like. And these people agree with Jesus' version of what God is like. Definitely. And as a result, their life looks like his life, which is the biggest threat to Satan's kingdom that exists.
And it goes back to where this all started, what started from in the beginning, that Satan hated the character of God. And because he knew God well enough, he knew he could get away with what he did with lies and insinuation. And he knew God wouldn't snuff out his life. He knew that, you know, that God would play it out, that he would have time. So I think it's fascinating when you study dynamics in relationships. As therapists, we always talk to look at triangulation, which means the real issue are between two people, but they often pull in a third party. So when you look at dysfunctional family dynamics, there's usually tension between two people, but another person is pulled in, and that actually escalates in terms of the tension between the two. But it's really about unresolved issues with that third party. And I see Satan just triangulating humans because he couldn't win with God. So that's part of why he puts all of his energy into trying to take us out, because he was unsuccessful with God. Mm-hmm. Couldn't pull it off, but he's going to bring everything he can, guns blazing, to take us out. And it's because these people are aligning with what Jesus said is true about God, that design law, God's only asked us to do what's good for ourselves, love him and love others. So makes more sense to me from that perspective.
I was thinking a little bit earlier about Jesus' prayer for his father when he says, I have finished, I have glorified you, your name. Mm-hmm. I have finished the work you gave me to do.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's the work Jesus had. That's his witness.
These people are doing the same thing. They're following the Lamb and his example of doing the work that the Father has asked them to do, which is to glorify his name by letting him live in them and live through them. So the testimony of Jesus as a human being, I think, is very important to understand. And that is that he came to show us what a normal human being was designed to look like, which was to live in the image of God. Mm-hmm. So God can't live in the image of God, but a human being can, because that's what a human being. That's why it was so important for Jesus to become human.
Right.
So that he could show us what it looks like to be a human, because nobody had ever done it.
Right.
So he came to reflect the image of God as an image of God instead of, that's why it was so important that he never depend on his own power to be good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
His greatest temptation as a human being was to use his own natural impulses to be good, to do the right thing, because it was natural for him to do the best thing, the good thing, the loving thing. And it was far more difficult for him to resist that temptation to do the good thing because he felt like it. And instead, he had to always depend on his Father for the power and defer everything to his Father as a human being, so that we could see that we could do the same thing. If we just defer everything to the Father and let the Father's will be instead of ours, then we can be restored to living as a normal human being, which is what we are designed for.
Okay, have we finished 17 adequately, or is there more? I don't know, Floyd, if everybody heard what you said.
Oh, I heard. I thought it was great.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of Brad and Nancy.
Oh, do you think they might still be listening if they just turned off their audio? Maybe not. I don't know.
Sorry, we're back.
Brad, did you hear what Floyd said?
Yes, but not as carefully as I would have liked to. Could you summarize the point? Or maybe Floyd could.
I think Floyd should.
Well, the testimony of Jesus as a human being, maybe that's why it specifically says Jesus here instead of Michael or the Lamb or some other title. Because Jesus is the human, the only normal human who has lived so far.
Mm-hmm.
And by normal, I mean by design in creation. Right. That we were humans are designed to be the image of God, which means to reflect him in every way possible. So Jesus had to become human,
right,
in order to do that. But in God becoming human, he has to continually resist the temptation to tap into his godness, which gives him natural, intuitive impulses to do the right thing, to bless, to forgive, to love. For him to do those things out of his own power was infinitely greater temptation, because he could. It was the natural thing to do, but he never did those things from his own natural instincts. He always chose to let the Father love through him, to let the Father forgive through him, to let the Father heal through him, even though he could do it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because he came to be our example, and we can't do those things by ourselves. So he chose not to do those things by himself. Our temptation is to follow our natural feelings and to do what we think is best and to rely on our own power, which is always going to mess up. But he had this exact same temptation. That's why he was tempted in every point as we are, without sin. He wasn't tempted to smoke. He was tempted to heal somebody who smoked. instead of letting the Father heal them. He was tempted to forgive an adulteress instead of letting the Father forgive. He was tempted to use his power to make stones into bread so he could eat instead of trusting his Father. So sin is not trusting the Father to reflect through us. And that's why he was tempted more than any of us will ever be tempted, because he would have done everything that he did, but he could have done it from his own power. But all he would demonstrate then is that we should depend on our own power. And that's not what he proved. So right. His testimony is, listen, a human being can love if he receives love. Exactly. And so he received love from his Father. He received healing power. He received forgiveness, not because he didn't have it, but because he was showing what a human being can do.
Well, I was just saying, yeah, that's scriptural. We love because he first loved us.
Right.
And all of the plan of salvation fits perfectly. If it's a broken relationship, the plan of salvation is to restore a relationship. As I see it.
I was just going to say pretty much the same thing, that the true power is the power of love.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about, it's bothered me for years that Adventists have preached getting power to overcome sin, power to overcome addictions, power to, and it doesn't work. I've watched it. It doesn't work. And it finally dawned on me one day, the only true power is the power of love.
Right.
And right. It's love that overcomes addictions, because addictions are built on a deficit of love. Yeah, I think it's spot on.
And that's scriptural too, when God's character is a reflection, or his laws are a reflection of his character. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And it seemed to you that you made an excellent point about how Jesus' testimony, I do nothing of my own accord. Right. And that's the very, God was in him, and then he invited us to experience, I want to be in you, I want God to be in us, you know, that interconnection, that the mystery of godliness, which is, you know, hinges directly on that, trusting God, depending on him, not myself. That makes more sense.
That's why the dragon is full of anger and fury at those who are demonstrating what Jesus demonstrated.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because if he gets exposed, if that lie crumbles, he mm-hmm. has no more basis for existence.
No.
His expiration is being accelerated.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll be interesting as we unpack the beast. You know, Satan's intention is to distort who God is. Mm-hmm. And uses all these powers to say, this is what power looks like, authority, and in especially the imposed law lens view, which so distorts that God isn't doing this for himself. Everything he asks of us is for our best. It's, you know, it's the law of love, which when we experience that and follow that, we enter into life. And Satan wants to distort our view of God, which he has effectively done.
So here's a proposal, drop it or take it. Can we review this chapter in 10 minutes and go to 13 next time?
If we got there in time, I was going to suggest that I was going to ask maybe that same question.
Or why don't we give it a shot? I think it's nicer for me, at least when we have been talking about it. Some's a little bit more distant, but I'd say let's give it a shot, see how far we get.
I believe
You know, we have more than 10 minutes. We've usually gone to 5:30. Are you able to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we are.
I don't know about Floyd, though.
I'm not on a schedule.
Okay. Then let's go for it. It strikes me that throughout this chapter, the woman figures large. It starts with this great sign in the heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and crown of 12 stars on her head. She's pregnant. She's in labor. This reads like a story. And she cries out because she's in labor and pain from giving birth. Then another sign appears in heaven, and it's a great fiery red dragon who hears her cries and comes to destroy the baby as it's born. And he's the one whose tail has already swept down a third of heaven's stars. And she gives birth to a son who gets snatched up to God in heaven. Dragon loses him. And then there's a break in the sequence of the story. There's war in heaven. This is a flashback. As good stories often have, there's a backflash of this war in heaven. And he comes down to the earth. You can say he's thrown down, whereas in Jude, you can say he left and came down. And his angels came down with him, or were thrown down with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven. Now's where we come in. We're suddenly in the story. The accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them night, day and night before our God has been thrown down, they gain the victory over him on account of the blood of the Lamb and the word of their witness. Love for their own lives didn't make them afraid to die. And therefore, rejoice, O you heavens and you who dwell therein. But, O horrors, look what this dragon is going to do on the earth. Mm-hmm. Now that we're in the story, this woman who has given birth to the male child keeps getting places of rescue, or means of rescue. Mm-hmm. Initially, it's a desert. Then a river comes after her from the mouth of the dragon, a river of lies, but the earth comes to help her. She learns about science and natural law. She learns about the way God created the orderly universe in which she lives. And it helps to get rid of these lies. And now that there's such clear evidence for the truth, the dragon gets really furious and he goes off to make war with her. Actually, not with her, but the rest of her children. Mm-hmm. Those who keep the commandments of love. We love because he first loved us. And hold on to the witness of Jesus, who said, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet who showed us that we could become back in the image of God by following and allowing his love to reign supreme in our hearts. I love the statement that she makes several times, Ellen White makes several times in Thoughts on the Mount of Blessing, that she talks about the sovereignty of love. Surrender to the sovereignty of love. I love that, because that's a totally different kind of sovereignty. And I think that's what's being depicted here. Now we're ready for part two of the story. No, I'm kidding. I know there's more to discuss.
I think the reason for this sudden amping up of the dragon's anger is specified as because he now knows he has but a short time. Mm-hmm. Which apparently, you know, his strategy up to this point did not include that.
Right.
So he may have had a focus on something entirely different, a long range plans. And now that suddenly he realizes there's an expiration date for him, mm-hmm. he shifts his whole focus in fury. Not his motivation is far more out of fury than what it was in the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't angry in the Garden of Eden. He was very crafty.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows how many other motives he had throughout the 4,000 years, but now that there's a new factor in this war that's been introduced that was completely unexpected, now he shifts over to just rage.
That's a rage of someone who's lost,
mm-hmm.
or who is losing the war.
I find it interesting that he would be accusing before God day and night when God knows he's tried to kill his son, you know, and his people. So why would God give him any time of day? It's almost like he's lost. He has no one that's going to listen to him. I don't. And then, of course, he's lost all credibility and influence. So it seems odd that he would think he could get God to listen.
Well, maybe that's a misapplication of those words.
Yeah, I think
so. Maybe he's not in front of the throne before God.
Yeah.
Maybe he's accusing them in front of God.
Yes.
He's actually masquerading as God. He tortured my conscience for many years, and I thought it was God doing it.
Yeah.
But he was accusing me day and night,
mm-hmm.
as if, and I was quite certain it was God, and God's still convincing me that wasn't him, which is a huge relief. But, now I realize that every accusation comes from the enemy, and that's why I need to be careful not to do it.
And there's no truth in any of them.
Well, God is very clear. I don't condemn you. God is not the accuser. Because I worked for years with people with, intense anxiety, guilty consciences. And I said, God convicts. God does not condemn.
Right.
He wants you to move towards the truth, because it's in acknowledging the truth that you're freed up, whatever that truth may be. And, but God is not a condemning God. He wants to use this conviction as a process of cleansing and healing and restoration. So God always uses truth, but not with Satan's guilt, shame, blame, accusation, condemnation approach.
You covered everything.
Mm-hmm.
A sobering quotation, I probably should look it up because I'm probably mangle it, but Ellen White talks about, I think it's criticism, fault finding.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, Satan is the accuser. We need to be careful to stay off of Satan's ground.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Judgment, criticalness. God says, don't judge. You don't know what you need to know about your place. I loved your recap, Jean. That made so much sense. And uh-huh. You did it in under 10 minutes. So I'm like,
I was just starting and it dawned on me, I'm reading a story. The thing is that I think this is the clearest story in all of Revelation.
Mm.
It's the clearest story type.
Well, this is the pivot point of the entire book.
I know.
This is the hub that everything attaches to. So it would make sense that you have the most concentrated revelation of the Great Controversy at the very heart of the prophecy about the Great Controversy.
But it's not in poetry as much as it is in story.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's striking, because if there's anybody in the universe that has loved to tell stories, it's God. I don't know who it was that started this. It was a Jewish man who started this story, and I may have told it, so if I did, stop me. So the story goes, God went to the Greeks and he said, what can you do for me? And the Greeks said, we can make you great sculptures and art. We have great art, great works of art. And God said, no, thank you. And he went to the Egyptians and he said, what can you do for me? And the Egyptian says, we're great philosophers. We have the greatest library of philosophy in the world in Alexandria, Egypt. We can do philosophy for you. And God said, no, thank you. And he went to others, the Mesopotamians, and they said, oh, we're the founders of civilization. We can make great civilizations, great empires for you. And God said, no, thank you. And he went to this little group of people in the middle between all the great powers. And he said, what can you do for me? And they said, well, God, we're great storytellers. Mm-hmm. We can tell your story. And God said, you will be my people.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
You left out the Babylonians.
Yeah. I've gone to many lectures, you know, where people have PowerPoints and really good presentations. And one, Dan Allender says, you're not going to remember any of these points, but you will remember the stories I tell you. So mm-hmm. here's a story. And I don't remember any of his points, but I remember his stories. That sticks on my brain, which illustrate the principles he was trying to teach. But I remember the story. So,
which means that God knows what he created us to have is stories.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not a long list of things we had to remember. And that's where the Babylonians missed it early on. They were the beginning of list makers.
Mm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to point fingers at anybody. I'm a list maker myself. Yeah, but they made lists of everything under the sun, moon, and stars, including the sun, moon, and stars.
But well, and this chapter is so like you were saying, so essential with the story, because war isn't just one of many themes in the Bible. It is the major theme and the entire backdrop in which the context between good and evil takes place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it began right in God's home, not ours.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us have forgotten the story. Most of the earth doesn't get the story. So many things don't make sense because you've forgotten the story where all that information fits in a story.
Mm-hmm.
Get the story. It's hard to remember.
Stories is what holds cultures and family identities together. Because it's the stories that we tell in our families and watching stories being played out in real time mm-hmm. is how our brain learns who we are and what our people are and how we act like our people. You know, and that's why I think the devil is so successful with television, movies, all these kind of things, because those are stories. And when we are emotionally caught up into those stories, we're subconsciously being trained on how to respond to situations and how to act like ourselves, but we don't realize we're being trained. But stories are what's actually conditioning us on how to react in various situations.
And a master at his parables, the stories, the cultural context that everyone could relate to.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, John Eldridge says if Jesus were here today, his parables would be video clips, just what you said, Floyd.
Mm. The thing that's different, though, between telling a story and viewing a story happening is that in telling a story, our imagination is working.
Yes.
We are absorbing the story through imagination, and it becomes part of us personally, but freely at the same time.
Right.
Whereas if we view a story, it's imprinted on our brain, forced on our brain, in a sense. We're not using our imagination. We're not receiving it. It's being stamped on us.
Exactly. In fact, when I was at PUC, I was in Company One, the religious drama, and you just described the difference between pantomime and acting. Acting tells a story and you're just entertained. pantomime, you're involved. What is that going on? Oh, what does that mean? Oh, that's true. Oh, okay. You've got a connection.
Mm-hmm.
Very different.
I remember Company One. I saw them do it, perform just once in Poland Hall. And if we enlarge this, if the books of heaven, which keep record, are really in our brains, as I'm becoming to really believe, based on some of the work of neuroscientists in the brain, how it works. At the end of time, we are basically admitting our stories.
Mm.
And we either have a great story of redemption or a horrific story of how we've hurt ourselves through hurting other people.
So
and
judgment.
What I would really like is some scientific evidence on whether the hurting that we do to other people, the stories that we enact and we hurt other people, whether that doesn't affect our neural brains just as badly as if it were done to us.
Mm.
That's what I would like to know, if there's scientific evidence for that. But I have nowhere to, I don't know where to look. The closest I've come to anything about neuroscience and that sort of thing is Bessel van der Kolk. Does that name ring a bell, Nancy?
Oh, yes.
His book, I bought his book recently called The Body Keeps the Score.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Jean, are you saying, let me make sure I heard you correctly. You said the stories we tell ourselves are just as powerful as what we experience?
No, the stories we create by mistreating other people, does that have an effect on it as if we did it to ourselves?
Well, this may be a little bit different. Dr. Jennings addressed this, and since I worked with a lot of abuse individuals, you know, they had to process through the horrific experiences that they had had. But if you ever ask them if they would rather have been the perpetrator or the victim, however horrendous being the victim is, they would never want to swap places and be the perpetrator.
Right.
There was a recognition of, okay, however bad that journey was, I'm glad I'm not the one that was inflicting that to others. And I understand, you know.
You know, that's helpful.
Abusers, thank you. I'm not saying that's not there, but when you look at that, and Jennings said it more succinctly and clearer than I am, but he says, no person that ever said, yeah, I want to swap. I'd rather be that person. They said, no, I never want to have that on myself. I'll work through this with God's help and correct therapies. But to participate in that kind of evil, I wouldn't want to swap places.
Yeah. That helps. Thank you. Because I'm convinced that, you know, Ellen White makes a statement in Thoughts on the Matter of Blessing. This is my favorite devotional book, so you'll hear about it a lot. I've read it umpteen times. She says that it's better to suffer, and I can't remember how she words it, but rather than to inflict the torture of retaliation upon ourselves. So I think she says to suffer in silence or something like that.
Then you become the monster.
And I think there's a backdrop to people's mistreatment of others. They've been mistreated.
Mm-hmm.
They're acting out of the way, you know, if they've had an abusive parent, they're acting out of the way they were raised and out of the way that parent treated them.
Hurt people hurt others.
Exactly. And so I see this as all just kind of a perpetual problem. The wish I have is that we could love people who are perpetrators adequately so that they would be willing to shed all of that, including the abuse they've suffered.
Right.
Well, I think when Jesus says, you know, forgiveness is linked to confession, ownership, personal responsibility, and that's key towards healing. And mm-hmm. and unfortunately, many perpetrators never move into that place of saying, I am responsible. I mm-hmm. chose this. Instead of blame, shame, finger pointing, it's essential to say, I need to look at this monster within. I need to look at what I chose. And, you know, that's yeah. got to be a moving towards healing. But if people are, you know, God can't do anything to help bring healing if we don't own what is ours to own.
Well, it's very, very delicate there. That is very hard to contribute to helping someone like that is the issue of identity, because everybody wants to label and slap a label of identity on a perpetrator and hate them, which reinforces the lie that that's who they are, mm-hmm. which is the problem to start with. They believe they're this evil person, and whatever you believe about yourself, you're going to act out, even if you hate it. And the salvation is believing in the truth about what God says about you and separating your condition from your identity. Yes, we need to confess our condition, but never confess it as our identity. And the world, and the devil especially, demands that we accept our condition as our identity. And until we are willing to say, I am that evil person, they're never going to be rest satisfied. And victims often want to reinforce this. And that's why it's so hard for perpetrators to be redeemed, because everybody's ganging up on them, say, well, you need to confess. This is, you're a wicked, evil person, and you're doing this kind of stuff. And most people believe it's hopeless and they'll never change, which then reinforces that lie in the person. That's why the gospel is more radical than people want to admit, because the gospel says, no, that is not who you are. Paul says, so were some of you. You thought you were these things, and you acted that way, but now you have been redeemed with a new identity. You discovered that's not how God sees you. You believe the truth about who you really were, and you have escaped that. Don't fall back into the labeling trap again. And this is especially applies to perpetrators. And that's a hard pill to swallow for most Christians. You know, we love to hate perpetrators, and we don't want to let go of that leverage and power we have over them, but we're destroying their lives.
I was going to say that it seems to me the only way a perpetrator can be brought to recognize what he has done, I'll just put it that way, is through being loved the way he is, unconditionally.
Yeah.
And when we love them for who they are in Christ, their true identity, not some mystical, ethereal, non-real religious identity, we cheapen it. But when we can bring a person, anybody, whether they're a victim or anything, I mean, I think the power of the gospel is a new identity. And when we believe, that's why Jesus emphasized so much believing. If you will believe, you believe on the Son of God. Well, what does that mean? It believes that God forgives you. It means you're forgiven. You're unconditionally loved. Who you are. That's what you need to believe. And that's how he treated prostitutes. That's how he treated tax collectors. He treated them according to their true identity, not according to the label they had. And that's why it was so radical. But then when he treated the rulers and the priests and the Pharisees based on their true identity, they didn't want that identity. They wanted their own righteousness as their identity. Whereas the open sinners, they're like, well, I'm sort of tired of this identity anyway. I like the way he treats me. That's why they were going into the kingdom before the Pharisees, because They were willing to trade in their old identity for the one he was giving them. And the Pharisees wouldn't do that.
Years ago, I was asked, my first paper in my master's program was to write the nature of man, my view of the nature of man. And I was just used to nursing where you had to memorize all this tons of stuff. And I go, oh my goodness, I don't know. What's my view of the nature of man? I have no idea. So I'm wandering around in the stacks in the library of Loma Linda going, oh Lord, I need your help. So he directed me to some journals. It was called the Journal of Psychology and Theology. So I pull one from the shelf and say, God, I need your help. I open it up and I'll never forget this line that was from this article about merging spirituality and psychology. I mean, religion and psychology. And it says, we are deeply fallen, but greatly loved. And I love that. I remember that so clearly, deeply fallen, but greatly loved. And we have to acknowledge we're deeply fallen. I think Matthew 18, Jesus is very clear about the impact of perpetration on a child, which is profound. It's better if you have a millstone around your neck and tossed into the sea. I think that's what he was talking about. But if people admit I'm deeply fallen, but greatly loved, you're right. We can move from that, from those horrendous acts against others and that profound impact psychologically and physically and emotionally. And anyway, but God wants to invite us into believing we are loved. And when we know we're loved, then we can face whatever the truth is about ourselves. And God can bring healing. If we don't face that truth, God can't bring healing. So I think you're spot on. Deeply fallen needs to be a part of that as well as greatly loved. And God is so good at offering. You're deeply loved.
Mm-hmm.
Greatly
loved,
even if you're deeply fallen.
I think it has to happen with being shown love, not just told.
Yeah. Love is an action word.
And that's the problem, because a victim sometimes can't access the perpetrator to show them forgiveness and love. I think it would have to be with a third party just observing in order for the safety.
And that doesn't have to be, you know, Trish wants to say something. I would just say, you don't have to do the, sometimes it's just not safe to be around people that have been perpetrators if they haven't gone through that process. And I always tell my clients, forgiveness is for you. You know, that releases you from the worst moments of your life. So God is asking you to forgive, and it doesn't mean you minimize or say it was okay or no impact, but you can relinquish and not hold on to the dark and replay those darkest moments in your life. So forgiveness allows victims to move on in their life instead of stuck in this perpetual review. So that's mine. But Trish, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I was just gonna say I basically agree with everything that I'm hearing from everyone. But there's a part of it I'm trying to get a handle on it, but it's not quite so straightforward, because I heard earlier on people saying things like, "Well, you know, don't, you know, it's hard for someone to feel love if they keep getting called evil, etc." And I don't think that necessarily perpetrators are called I think what's at the core in a lot of abuse situations of the people who are doing harm to others is that not necessarily they're evil, but they're motivated by a very, very, very deep sense of shame, their own personal shame. So in some places I would substitute the shame rather than evil. And that's why I think it's so hard for people who do harm to others to really hear that message that you are loved, because for them, and it's not even, I don't think, accessible to some people, but they are motivated by this incredibly deep sense of shame. And so that love is so in opposition to that, that sometimes it seems, I don't think it's impossible. I'm just saying they almost recoil when you want to love them, because that shame says to them in a such a deep way, they are not lovable. Does that make sense? It's almost like they can't hear it. They cannot hear it because that other deeper message of being shamed is stronger.
I couldn't agree with you more, Trish. Mm-hmm. In fact, this whole conversation, this verse keeps resonating in my head, which is the message to Laodicea: buy of me white raiment that the shame of your nakedness not be seen. It's not the nakedness that's the problem. Nakedness is honesty and transparency. It's the shame that's killing us. Mm-hmm. And in Hebrews 12.
Yeah, and it really is. Yeah.
In Hebrews 12, Jesus endured the cross, but he despised the shame because the shame is the real enemy. Mm-hmm. The shame is what blocks us from ever believing that God can love us, that we can be forgiven. The shame is what's killing us. And Jesus let the shame kill him to disarm it. And only the power of the Holy Spirit can break through that shame. That's, you can't convince somebody not to be ashamed. The Holy Spirit has to liberate them. And I know, I know a whole lot about shame. And shame is the currency of the devil.
Yes.
And,
that's it.
And we're afraid of shame, so we can't even admit things because we know that people around us are going to shame us for it. And we're terrified of shame because shame, the word shame means I'm worthless. Mm-hmm. I have no value. Nobody cares. I have no reason for people to care about me. I don't deserve to be loved. That's why it does no good to say you're loved, because if you're ashamed and you believe in the scale system, that means you have to do something in order to be loved. And I'm too bad to be loved. Therefore, I cannot believe you. You can tell me all day God loves me, but I'm not going to believe you because I'm too ashamed. And the shame, you're right. The shame has to be dealt with before you can even begin believing that you're loved.
That's what I'm wondering. Well said, Floyd. I'm wondering if shame is the devil's counterfeit to God's unconditional love of sinners.
Right. What? And it has to be the Holy Spirit working, because it's to me anyway, it seems very mystifying why a victim is also feels great shame, but the perpetrator feels probably, you know, why one person can see their shame and uncover it, and why in other people it's such a thing that they never can get past it, and all they can do with it is hurt other people.
Yeah, I think shame is the unsung villain.
I wonder if, depending on the kind of shame they have, if perhaps they have built a solid wall of ice that dulls any sensitivity to anything.
I think that's true 100%. Yeah, but I guess I'm always curious, like, as to why.
Yeah. I don't
some
know
people,
that
some people, why
answer.
Some people build that wall and other people remain more vulnerable, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That reminds me of a quasi-vision I had many years ago when God was finally starting to get through and start dealing with my shame. And, you know, in prayer, and I was really asking for God to do whatever, you know, to show me even what was inside. And I just remember having this sudden picture of this walk-in freezer. You know how God uses crazy analogies sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's this walk-in freezer with these shelves, and I, you know, it's dark in there, right, for one thing. And you walk in there, and there was these ice carvings on the shelf of heads with faces on them, with different emotions on these faces. And it was shame, anger, fear, you know, there was these heads representing all these emotions that were me. And they were frozen in place. And they were controlling me. They were hidden, buried in there, but yet they acted as triggers. And God says, I want to open this place up and let the sun in so they can melt, so they lose their power. Let the heat in. Let the warmth of love come in. Let me have access to this. And boy, I started melting right away just at that revelation. It's like, really? You could do this? You could do this? Wow, yes, I'd love that.
Yeah, that's a fantastic vision. But you were asking, right? You were praying, right? You were asking.
I've been asking my whole life, you know, because my pictures of God growing up were very intimidating. I mean, he was the ultimate critical fault finder, looking for an excuse to punish me all the time. And, you know, and behind that is anger, fear, shame, humiliation, all those things were just like walls around. And, you know, God's still dealing with that stuff, but he's making a lot of progress since then.
Well, that is the testimony of Jesus. I do not condemn you. Mm-hmm. And so many references in the Bible. Because when we talk about shame, all of us have been, when I'm ashamed, I drop my eyes, I drop my head. I don't want to look at you. I don't want to. And Jesus is the lifter of our heads. He's always raising our faces, our chins, to try to help us see how he sees us, which is always through the lens of love. Shame is a tool of the devil, and it is based on fear of rejection. And so there's this refusal to move into openness and to light, which keeps us locked into shame. So I just love that Jesus is the lifter of our heads, and he doesn't want us to see that critical, judgmental, angry God who's just waiting to find fault. That is the testimony of Jesus, is opposite of that.
That raises an interesting specter that I just heard recently from someone, that there's actually a movement by some people dealing with this very issue, and they no longer believe in bowing their head in prayer because that's a sign of shame.
That's really interesting. That's interesting.
And you know, Hebrews says, now we come boldly before the throne of grace. We're not hanging our head in shame. And we've always equated bowing your head with reverence, but what if it actually means shame and it's just camouflage?
The Old Testament.
That's funny. Yeah, that's funny, because I've always wondered that. Actually, that's really funny you should say it. I've always wondered that. Sometimes I've always wondered, isn't it more appropriate that we like look up to God while we're praying, you know? But
this is the Old Testament, New Testament way of praying.
Yeah. And you know what the opposite of shame is in the English language? Glory. God's glory. Opposite of glory is shame.
And that makes worth, because, I mean, it makes sense, because glory is worthiness.
Yes.
And yeah, so when
honor.
We see God as worthy of our worship, it's because he's the source of our value that removes the shame. And when we feel worthy, we feel worthy because we're reflecting the one who is worthy, and our worth is found in him, and what he says about us is trustworthy, then we can lift up our heads and have the light reflecting off our face instead of hanging them in shame, thinking that we're appeasing him by bowing.
And so that word in Hebrew, kavod, for glory, means honor.
Yes. Right.
Honor is the absolute opposite of shame.
Yes.
God honors us with his glory.
And he's adopted us into his family.
Right.
Yeah. Christ. So that ought to boost our identity right there.
Well, it's 5:33. This has been a great afternoon. Mm-hmm. Thank you, everybody. Let's have our closing prayer. Gracious Father, we thank you that you have chosen to rob the enemy of his power over us, that you have brought us light and truth and love to bring healing and restoration and to lift up our face, which is the meaning of forgiveness in the Old Testament, and look you in the eyes. We ask that we may not only enjoy this wonderful privilege that you give us ourselves, but that we will be reflectors of it to others who suffer from shame and guilt and all the things that the enemy accuses them of. We pray for this in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Amen.